So let's dive in and let's talk a little bit more about ChatGPT and all of the periphera. Who uses periphera?
Literally nailed it to the last word.
Listen. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Asimu Decoded. This is episode 2 of season 2, and today we're decoding ChatGPT and beyond. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and consider leaving us an Apple Podcast review. It helps us get connected to folks who might be interested in the conversations we're having. We'd love to know what you think, and we sure appreciate it. So you have almost certainly heard about ChatGPT. It's been all over the news. It has absolutely exploded in popularity and in public discussion. So we have a great conversation in store for you today and can't wait to get started. I'm Jess.
And I'm Aaron.
And we're your co-hosts. And we're going to dive right in. You have very likely heard and seen the completely bonkers level of coverage about OpenAI's generative AI tool, ChatGPT. Every tech and non-tech publication, it seems, has covered it in some capacity, and we're going to talk about it a little bit today. It's been very interesting for us to see the explosion in public discussion and public use about this consumer tool, because we've actually been using this infrastructure in our labs for a couple of years now. We're going to go in and talk a little bit more deeply about ChatGPT and the underlying infrastructure, but just to set the stage, we wanted to call out that ChatGPT is the fastest growing application in history. You would know this if you have subscribed to our newsletter. We talked about this in our April issue. GPT-4, which is the latest version of the framework that ChatGPT was built on, has passed some of the most difficult exams out there. So including the Uniform Bar Exam, SAT, the GRE, and more. It's been used by students in school to write essays and create, you know, other content for assignments. And that's led to some really interesting discussion in terms of plagiarism and, you know, what are the acceptable uses of this, especially in a school setting. So ChatGPT's popularity is affecting generations older and younger alike. The popularity of ChatGPT has led to a lot of debate about automation in the workplace. So what does it mean for certain roles like software developers or content creators? It's changed how we work with the internet, and we're going to talk a lot more about that. Aaron, anything else that you would want to highlight in terms of just stage setting for ChatGPT?
I would want to talk about the hype, first off. Like, if you jump in there and compare this to, for example, the crypto craze, right? Because it seemed like everyone was into Bitcoins and NFTs and whatnot. But we were saying kind of, you know, all along on the crypto side that there's really not much there. There's a lot of money moving around, and in some ways there's pyramid scheme-like things going on. But from a core level, the blockchain technology didn't seem as disruptive as everyone would like you to believe who was into it. However, with ChatGPT, I would say that the opposite is true. It's hard to exaggerate the potential uses and talk about the foundational ways in which this technology will change society. So as part of our role here on Asimu Decoded, I think it's really important to try and separate as much as possible the snake oil from the technology and the potential uses of technology. So I'm really excited that today we can give a two thumbs up, at least for the intensity of change with regards to ChatGPT. There's lots of thumbs ups and thumbs down all across the board on it, but it will and has already shifted the way our society functions.
So today's episode is going to be a little different than many of our past episodes because we're going to be interviewing each other, or really, I'm going to be interviewing Aaron today. Aaron is our resident in-house expert on ChatGPT and the underlying infrastructure. And I mentioned, you know, we've been using this tool in our labs for some time now, not ChatGPT, but the underlying infrastructure. And so we have a lot of experience with it, as much as you can, for something that is emerging. And for some of you longer-term listeners, you may remember Mio, And Mio was built using the same technology. So if you want to go back and listen to some of those past episodes or check out some of our blog posts, you can get to know Mio a little bit. Aaron, let's start at the beginning and let's talk a little bit about specifically about ChatGPT and this consumer tool that's been developed and that's really taken off in terms of popularity. Can you just talk a little bit about what it is and how it's being used?
Absolutely. So I think it's interesting and a nice place to start to talk about what GPT stands for in general. So because everyone knows about ChatGPT, but the underlying technology is generative pre-trained transformer technology. And in 2017, an interesting thing happened. And Google released research that identified a new type of model that was constructed, a transformer model. And then it kind of like slept a little for a few years. And researchers were playing with it and looking at it. And then in 2020, it started to really take off. And what we see today and the explosion in AI and machine learning tools is in large part a result of the transformer technology that was developed just in the very recent past. Now, in the history of AI, AI goes through different phases and time periods. You will hear, if you study AI, you'll hear about AI winters when the hype cycles get really big, but there's not a, the proof in the pudding isn't there. And then the funding, the media interest, everything comes back and reduces, and then you have an AI winter. We are without a doubt clearly in the middle of one of the largest AI summers that we've ever experienced, and it is in large part due to this transformer technology. So when we talk about this series of generative technologies, what that means is it's basically as simple as predicting the next thing in a sequence. So for example, if we're talking about language and I say the big brown dog jumped over the, and what would you say, Jess?
Lazy fox, right?
Okay, you would not perform as well as the large language models out there. I believe the sentence that, and maybe it's because I'm a different generation and I had to do typing in school, but I believe it's the big brown dog jumped over the fence. But you check that out and let me know. So these generative models are really good about predicting the next word in a sequence or a series of words. And when we talk about language, however, what is interesting about these models is that many things can be converted into a logical sequence of what's the next thing. So DNA sequences, sound, words. And so this technology, one of the interesting things about the generative technology is that it can span across robotics, bioinformatics, genetics, language, and many things in which in the past were considered separate fields of study for AI researchers.
That's super helpful. I have an update. We're both wrong. GPT is both of us. So It is the quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. I think I should get partial credit because I worked with your example.
That's hilarious.
If you want to know a fun fact, this sentence that we've been debating is called a pangram, meaning it contains every letter of the alphabet. It's also referred to as a holo alphabetic sentence, which I think is super cool. Pangrams are used to display typeface, test equipment, and develop skills in handwriting, calligraphy, and keyboarding. So let's listen to that sentence one more time. The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. Not to lean into the tropes too much, but as a cat person, I fully support this.
Well, and this is funny because, when one of the big criticisms of the large language model specifically, of which GPT-3 or ChatGPT, GPT-4 is a part of, is that they are very creative and they'll hallucinate. They'll give factual information that sounds very, very accurate and it'll be completely wrong.
So this idea of hallucination has major implications for how these tools can and should be used. It's in part one reason why there are disclaimers on tools like ChatGPT discouraging use for medical or legal advice. You can check out any number of articles on this issue. Even the New York Times recently posted about it. On a more philosophical note, it's interesting to consider the alignment between human and AI hallucinations. One is a result of altered brain chemistry, and the other, we're still trying to figure out why it's happening. But you might draw some interesting parallels. Anyway, in the short run, if you're using these tools, use them as well, tools, and be discerning.
One of my thoughts on that and or responses to that is that humans also do the same thing, right? So it's not like we're, 100% factually accurate, and it's even debatable whether that's a possibility to achieve at all, philosophically. So when we get into the ethics of these new types of technologies, it's important to understand that we need constraints and we should always be fact-checking. But frankly, that's true with humans as well.
Yeah, there's certainly two sides to this coin, right? There's a lot of really exciting opportunities and how this can be used, and a lot of things to consider to make sure that it's not used in a way that could have really detrimental effects, because the scale, I think, at which things can happen is so massive. So Aaron, you talked a little bit about the high level timeline of this tooling, and starting from 2017 to 2020, when there was, kind of these mild AI summers, right? And I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about, like, what was your experience and what was your initial thinking? Why did you bring it into our labs? And how long have we been working with it?
So we actually had access to the GPT series from OpenAI before it was accessible to the public through a special access API. And when I first heard about the technology and saw some of the initial reports, it seemed quite interesting, because one of the difficulties with machine learning in general has been working with natural language and unstructured data in a way that is anywhere close to a human level. And chatbots, have been clearly, they're clearly identifiable when you go online historically and try and work through your ticketing system, or when you talk with Siri or Alexa, then often they don't understand you. You can't talk with them like you would with another human. The flow of conversation has to be very distinct and specific. And it's just been annoying. So as a technologist, I was curious, what's the state of the art like? And the ability to process language specifically has a lot of benefit for our domain, because when we're dealing with social problems, there's often a lack of shared language across different domains. We might be talking about people, but we will talk about students in the context of education. We might talk about justice-involved individuals in the criminal justice area. We might be discussing patients, right, in the health and in space. So this idea of technology that could handle language to a higher level than previously before, it was very interesting to me. And then I got access to the model. And it would be disingenuous of me to say anything other than I was absolutely floored. Because here was a model that was very indistinguishable from talking with another human, could do things that seemed not just a stair step up, but a whole order of magnitude more complex than previously, that we never even thought of, that could do simple mathematics, but only studying language, right? Not with the mathematical rules embedded into it. And talking with this initial model, you had the sense that you were dealing with something that was unique. I'll say this idea of interacting with the machine and feeling something akin to a connection that's beyond machineness has been there from the very beginning of chatbots. As soon as machines, back with Eliza research, decades ago, humans, even with the first simple chatbots, have a tendency to want to anthropomorphize these machines and their connection to these machines and feel emotions and whatnot. However, when a machine can talk to you in a way that's indistinguishable from another human, that phenomenon takes on a whole new level of intensity. So it's very important to note that when you're interacting with these language models, and it was something that I experienced viscerally before the rest of the world even did. Some of the other uses that we originally were thinking of were around text manipulation. So one of the things that it's very important to for us to be able to do is to convert really complex text into simple text. So in the legislative realm, for example, if you've ever tried to read through state or federal law, like legislation, it's not the most accessible wording in the world. And so this model, we were interested in, can this model actually translate that into a different level of comprehension so that it's more accessible? In addition, there's something called entity detection, where you determine whether certain types of data correspond to things in the real world, like a person or an address. So if you say, for example, the difference between Aaron Bean and Aaron's Furniture Store, right? One is a place of business and the other is a person. And then if you have the Aaron Bean Foundation or the Aaron Bean Center, then you now have a different type of organization, which, you know, may be philanthropic in nature. So these types of distinctions are really nuanced, and they're not so obvious from a keyword perspective. If you're just looking at the words, Aaron Bean may be in each one of these, but the meaning of what Aaron Bean is pointing to is very different in each one of those examples. And that particular use case right there was something we were absolutely very interested in.
Right. So summarizing those, one is, and I think a lot of folks have been using ChatGPT in this capacity, which is summarizing or providing summaries of information that would take hours to go through and digest and make meaning out of. And then the other use case that you described is really supporting the identification of different types of things, which may, you know, that I think is pretty exciting to folks like us who are working in the tech space and can see ways to integrate it into tooling. Can you talk a little bit more about how that might be used in a system and what does that feel like for the everyday user?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And one of the areas that I feel there's a lot of benefit even yet to come, and we've already seen ChatGPT being integrated, is in searching. So we're considering getting a new animal in our household, right? And if I'm talking about a puppy, right, then there's a distinct difference between a puppy and a dog, right? A dog is could be a puppy, but a puppy is a younger dog. But from a word perspective, there's really nothing similar at all about those two words. So the letters are different, although the meaning is very, very close and related. So if you're searching through documents online, then you don't want to have to necessarily distinguish to that level of nuance. You just want to know about, you know, the thing you're looking for. So this idea of semantic search, which can cross the meaning of words, even when the words themselves are not similar, is very important. And we've already started incorporating that into the knowledge management systems that we build. So if you want to look for resources about puppies, but you put in, you know, show me resources about dogs, resources about puppies will come up as well.
Right. So it really accelerates the discovery of the kind of information that you're looking for.
Right.
Can you describe the relationship between semantic search, which is what you're describing, right? And tools like ChatGPT, like where's the overlap?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the overlap is in how the transformer technology works that underpins it. And the way that technology works, it calculates distinct and very, very distant relationships between concepts, between data points, we'll say. And so when you think about concepts like a puppy or and a dog and an animal in a zoo, those tend to be very close, you know, a kennel perhaps. But then if you think of things like conservationism or biological research, right, then they're still related, but they're not as closely related. So this multidimensional space of related data elements is something the transformer technology can map out in a way that's much more advanced than anything that we've done before.
So in other words, the responses that you get back from ChatGPT and similar tools is going to be much more comprehensive and similar as though you were interacting with another person.
Right. These concepts that we can hold in our heads naturally from acquired language and cultural experience, it is able to extract through data and pattern recognition. Now, importantly, we can't, as humans, hold concepts in that manner when we're looking at, say, the like sound or images, and we're looking at the actual relationships between those things at a machine level. But these generative technologies can do that as well.
So then a really important question for you is, what kind of dog are you going to get?
So the preference is big and not shedding very much. Love recommendations.
Well, there you go. There's a great use case. I mean, it's a fun tool. Even though we've been working and using this in our labs and for a few years now, I myself went, you know, and I've started to use ChatGPT. We have a number of team members who have as well. And what's a use case, if you have one, that you didn't expect to use ChatGPT for?
I use it 5 to 10 times a day, at least every day. And part of the interesting thing about ChatGPT is there are things it can do that the researchers did not predict. So there's emergent phenomena that has to do with this. What I use it for, though, is really rote things. So, for example, my daughter and I we had some expired popcorn, and we didn't know if expired popcorn was safe to eat. I imagine it probably was, but I went to ChatGPT instead of Google. Now, I will caveat that with, that's not the best use case to give, because you should not be using it on things that could impact your health. You should fact check that, right? However, I use it as a search engine. I used it this morning to generate a series of text in a Google document. I was giving some narratives to some slides, and literally I was just typing slide 1, slide 2, slide 3, and I had 30 slides, and I didn't want to type out all the headings. So I went into ChatGPT and I said, slide 1, slide 2, you know, build this out up to 30 slides. And it just gave me the headings. That saved me, I don't know, 45 seconds maybe? The other things I'll use it for are generating game ideas to play with my daughter, stories, like rough drafts of content that I'm thinking about that might be either marketing related or could be even turning a draft of bullet points into a statement of work. I used it for a statement of work the other day whenever I had a list of bullet points of the background for this statement of work that I was creating, and I needed it in narrative form. And it's not like converting a list of value bullet points into narrative form has a bunch of extra special added magic that I'm going to be able to do. Another area that you'll specifically appreciate is I have relied on you, Jess, to help me with edits to my emails for the entire existence of our business relationship together. And I'm now going to ChatGPT, so I don't have to bug you about that, and say, can you make this into a simpler, more grammatically sound email?
Yeah, that's amazing. Thanks, ChatGPT. Saving a little bit of time every day. Yeah, those are great examples. I mean, and so widely varied. I know we've had team members who've shared things like creating garden plans, you know, give me, you know, what should I plant where and when, and what should I not plant together, so you can summarize, you know, so much information and create some pretty cool outcomes.
I tend to use it less creatively in some instances than others out there, because I'm a little careful with how I want to access the tooling. But there's a lot of use cases out there that are frankly could be considered dangerous. So I've seen it through forums and all my reports of people using it for mental health advice, people who maybe have challenges creating social relationships, using it as a friend, people who maybe don't use it as a friend, but use it to advise on how to find friends elsewhere and or the things to talk about, all the way through to students. Of course, you'll see all the education stuff if you follow the news on that, about students using it to do their schoolwork. So I think there's a lot of power in the tool and a lot of areas where it could be also very dangerous, and there's unintended consequences that could happen out of it. So however it's used, always a little bit of skepticism is important to keep.
It's a great segue to talk a little bit about some of those challenges, specifically in the risks associated with using tools like this. Can you say a little bit more about why those kinds of use cases might be risky or potentially generate unintended outcomes, or even more broadly beyond those outcomes?
Absolutely. One of the things to keep in mind is these models were trained on vast quantities of text data. And that includes the, you know, much of the internet, including forums like Reddit or websites that may have a wide variety of views on things. So there's biases that come through in our societal, the way that we think and talk about other individuals and institutions that are very dangerous and inaccurate. And these tools are at risk of enhancing those biases when we interact with them. So we also have to be aware that they're not trained experts, although like they can perform as good or better in many cases than trained experts. They are not trained experts. So these tools don't have an ethical mandate in their programming beyond what the engineers are trying to put in there. These tools don't have consciousness the way humans do in a sense of thinking about morals. So that's a really important distinction that comes into play when you think about things around ethics and fairness and how we treat others, especially in critical life decisions around mental wellness and or, you know, who receives a financial assistance or a loan or who may be involved in some sort of justice involvement event like incarceration.
Those are great points. And we, you know, even when we're using it internally, we continually point out, this is just a tool, right? It's intended to help accelerate work, but you still need to fact check. You still need to be conscious that there may be errors and maybe drawing from uninformed or biased, you know, sources. It's just a lot of, you have to still think critically. I think that's one of the takeaways, you know, for me. Switching gears a little bit, because so much of our audience is focused on social impact work and, you know, we have a lot of folks in the nonprofit space working in philanthropy. Have you thought about some of the use cases and positive implications for folks in those domains to be able to use a tool like this?
This is where the ethics becomes very important on how we apply these tools. And although the technology is advancing in a manner that suggests we should incorporate it as quickly as possible in order to not be left behind, we also need to be very intentional and judicious with how we incorporate it. So I'll give some possible examples with a big asterisk on this technology is so new that it needs more policies and principles around it before we start incorporating it too quickly. One study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is a peer-reviewed medical journal published about 48 times a year by the AMA, used data from Reddit's Ask Docs forum. And what they did is they took data where Reddit members can ask medical questions that are answered, and they're answered by verified healthcare professionals, not the average Redditor, which would not be where you would want to go to get medical advice. And so these verified healthcare professionals answer these questions, and then the research team took about 200 samples from these exchanges where a verified doctor had responded to a question. And then they posed the same questions to OpenAI's ChatGPT, and they asked it to respond. And then they took healthcare professionals who rated both the accuracy and the empathy or bedside manner of those responses. Okay, now it's important to note that the panelists who were rating these did not know whether the answer was coming from ChatGPT or an actual healthcare professional. And what the study found is that the panelists rating these answers preferred ChatGPT's responses to those given by a human 79% of the time. They were rated good or very good quality 79% of the time, compared with 22% of doctors' responses. So they basically thought, that, I mean, it wasn't even close, that there were dramatically better answers, number one. But then maybe more surprisingly, 45% of ChatGPT's answers were rated empathic or very empathic, compared with, wait for it, 5% of human doctors. So with all of the caveats that we talked about the ethics and not going out to use this tool for medical advice, there's a clear sign that there's potential for it to enhance the service delivery and accuracy in the medical profession. Whether or not that's I don't suggest you go online and use it through ChatGPT, but it could be embedded into other tools.
Do you have any theories as to why those outcomes were the way they were?
I do. For one thing, what humans are good at and what machines are good at, it's kind of good to think about the differences there. And what machines are good at is having vast amounts of information they can traverse very quickly and come back with a response from that information. It's very difficult for humans to hold all that information inside their head. So I'm unsurprised that the accuracy was higher because the large language models can understand more complex topics that were previously not as easy for them to gather. I think the empathy question is maybe a little more, I'm not going to go as far into assumptions there, but if you've ever had a visit where you left a doctor's office going, man, I just felt like I was in and out, right? And that they weren't really listening with care and concern. You know, language models don't get tired. They don't have a bad day. Their new puppy didn't chew up their favorite pair of shoes. So there's a lot of things that humans have to deal with that come into our emotional state that language models don't. And that's good and bad.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm asking questions you may not know, but do you know if it was trained to consider a good bedside manner, or these were just the organic responses that came from ChatGPT?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, actually. It wasn't trained. It wasn't a fine-tuned model in the sense that it wasn't specifically trained on medical data. It came from ChatGPT-4. However, you can do some interesting things and nuances using prompt engineering, and I'm not sure what types of prompt engineering the team did there. However, I will say that prompt engineering is so much simpler than traditional fine-tuning of machine learning data sets. So this is an accessible technique. Like, the average person can learn prompt engineering very, very easily versus having to spend years studying data science techniques.
Could you equate prompt engineering to an interviewer asking good questions, essentially?
I think that's a great analogy there.
So to recap, prompt engineering is an entire field of work on its own, and prompt engineers take large language models and try to figure out what makes them tick. They use carefully crafted prompts to take language models like GPT-3 or GPT-4 all the way to the limits of their capabilities, and in doing so, they're helping other designers fix issues and weaknesses in the machine. So what Aaron is talking about is using prompt engineering to tailor a machine's outputs to something very specific, like healthcare. So to go a little deeper, prompt engineering, this process of designing and optimizing prompts or input queries, is really to ensure that we're obtaining the most desirable or useful responses from these language models. It's a really critical role in harnessing the potential of these AI models, especially given that their behavior is largely determined by the prompt itself. So if you're using ChatGPT or other tools like ChatGPT, you should think about a few key aspects when it comes to prompt engineering. The first is effectiveness. Well-engineered prompts enable the model to generate more accurate and contextually relevant responses. This is particularly critical in applications where precision is necessary, such as in the medical or legal domains. The second thing to think about is efficiency. By carefully crafting prompts, we can minimize the back and forth often needed to get the right response, saving time and computational resources. The third thing to think about is control. Through prompt engineering, we can guide the AI's output in a certain direction or style, or to exhibit certain behaviors without the need for retraining the model. Now, here's something interesting to think about. While it might seem logical to assume that a more detailed prompt is going to yield better results, that's actually not always the case. Sometimes an overly specific or complex prompt can lead to less desirable outputs. The AI might get confused by too much information. This is why prompt engineering often involves a balance of providing enough detail to guide the model, but not so much that it restricts or confuses the output. It's just as much an art as it is science.
You know, it's just setting context.
Okay, so for this next couple of questions, we used ChatGPT to generate questions to ask as part of this interview. So we're getting a little meta here. And one of our team members gave the context. So this would be an example of prompt engineering. I think that, you know, these are pretty good questions that came out of it. We explained, you know, that we run a podcast and this is a little bit of what it's about. Okay, so let's start with the first question from ChatGPT. What are some challenges associated with incorporating AI and chatbots into social impact work, and how can organizations overcome those challenges?
So a few challenges. One is the way that processes and systems have been built to create efficiency in organizational workspaces. Having considered that natural language can be incorporated in and information can be accessed that easily. All of our workflows are built around we searching and retrieving using much more difficult and narrow things, you know, filters that you have to drop down and click things on, titles that were built by someone 20 years ago and you don't remember like which one exactly it is and what it was. So our systems, process systems, as well as technology systems, are not built with this new paradigm, this idea that we can incorporate information directly into a work stream using things like natural language. So the first challenge is to break our mold of what's even possible. And that's not easy. And we've spent now the last year trying to even understand the capabilities inside of Simeo and envision and be creative about how we could re-envision how processes and technology works in this space. Number two, our process and people and technology systems already have bias and biases encoded into them. We're a very high risk of solidifying those further or superpowering those biases if we're not very careful and we're not very judicious and intentional about how we use these tools. Let's say you give a child, because in a way we're children understanding these tools, like we don't know how, like what their possibilities and potentials are, where we have a new age upon us and we're kind of stumbling around in the dark in a certain degree. If you give a child, you know, like a toy plastic gun, then that's one thing to deal with. If you give a child a BB gun, that's another thing to deal with. If you give them a tank or a button to a nuclear bomb, that's a different thing to deal with. And we just advanced dramatically in the tooling that we have access to. So we have to be very careful about well-intentioned and accidental misuse. And then third, the constraints to check the work, to understand what is and isn't factual, and keep strange and creative model things from integrating into our workflow in ways that humans, well, that are not obvious, is important. These models can, as many have stated, hallucinate in a way, like create things. They'll create, you know, early on we were testing it, you could ask them about a Simeo, and they would create, and me, Aaron, or you, just whole biographies of organizations that were close or semi-plausible in ways, but they would change one key fact, like we were founded in Albuquerque instead of Tulsa, or that Aaron is an AI researcher instead of a returned Peace Corps volunteer. I mean, it just will make stuff up. And so we haven't yet put the guardrails and constraints in place. And then, in a really tangential to that is, we don't have societal policies and laws and institutionalized ways of thinking about this stuff in place. When I've been advocating over the last really few years, but specifically the last 12 months, very, very, very passionately with government policymakers and leadership in various types of social service or philanthropic organizations, it's hard to indicate the level of change that's coming up. Like before the internet happened, how could you even predict and advocate for that? So getting new policy frameworks in place very quickly and principles is going to be very important and challenging. There's a few recent studies that even the last few months, this is an example of how what a breakneck pace this research is moving in. In the last few months alone, there have been several studies on fMRI and the generative models. And the studies are looking at, can you train a model using fMRI to predict what someone's actually thinking, right? So what happens is they have individuals and they run the fMRI on them and then what they do is they create a model that predicts if they can tell what that person is looking at or thinking, right? And what happens is using the fMRI scans alone and the training, the models, they can actually predict a person's internal dialogue to a degree of accuracy that is scarily akin to mind reading. What they specifically in a few of these research studies, what they did is they had an individual watch a movie, and then using an fMRI scan, they were able to recreate the internal dialogue of a clip from that movie. So in this one instance, this example of a girl who's riding a horse and then gets knocked off the horse, and then the AI model using fMRI only in the brain scan basically says, I see a girl who looks like me who gets knocked off a horse,
right?
Now that's your internal dialogue, right? That's non-invasive.
What?
Yes.
fMRI, just for those if you're wondering, I had to look this up real quick. So functional magnetic resonance imaging. So like an MRI machine is what we're talking about. That I hadn't heard about that. That's wild.
It is wild. It's, and now, you know, there's all sorts of caveats. You need to have, you know, hours of training inside, you know, an MRI machine in order to get like baseline data for an individual. So it's not, it has to be cooperative at this point. It's not like, you know, scientists can throw you in a room, even though I don't know, you know, I don't know what access we, that's classified that we don't have access to, but with, you know, staying away from, you know, speculation and conspiracy theories, it's not known that someone could just put you inside a room and put a helmet on you and read your mind. However, with that said, we're a whole lot closer than we were just a few months ago. And that itself is scary because if we know anything about science, as soon as we get a foothold somewhere, you know, we may run into challenges that make it impossible to ever do this, but we're very good at humans at being persistent and trying to like carve out more knowledge in that space. And this is one example, but there's examples across multiple disciplines right now that are mind-breakingly like things that we couldn't even imagine a few years ago.
That is so fascinating. And, you know, I'm way out of my lane in terms of expertise, but you can start to imagine the potential applications in treatment for, you know, different mental health challenges. And even if it's not on an every individual basis, just to be able to even assess the efficacy of certain interventions by predicting and seeing these kinds of outcomes. That, I mean, that's just one use case. That's wild.
Yes. So when we think about advances like this, we haven't had to have laws to protect the privacy of our inner dialogue, right? Right. That seems insane to us in our society. We would have to have a law to do that. But these types of things are on the horizon in some way. Now, another example is these models have been shown to have a theory of mind, and I don't have a psychology background. I didn't know what theory of mind was. So I went and looked at this, and that's the ability to understand and anticipate or guess at the mental state of another agent, like another human. Okay. So to think like, oh, about your emotions, your thoughts, your goals, and then I can infer things about that on your actions and predict what you might do. Well, a few months ago, it was discovered that GPT has a theory of mind equal to that of a 9-year-old human. And this wasn't known previously, by the way. This is the scary thing about these emergent properties of these large language models. So we didn't know that it could basically guess at, think of, represent internally in its model your mental state as well as a 9-year-old. But then, since then, in researching for this podcast, researchers have actually advanced it so that it can pass theory of mind tests better than humans at 100%, actually. So that's just happened in a few months.
So what does that mean to pass a theory of mind test?
It is an indicator of advancement in things like reasoning, right? And so, for example, if you say, so Sally is going to the prom tonight, and Sally puts her high heels under her dress and leaves to go buy, you know, something for prom. And then Sally's sister Anne comes into her room and puts Sally's high heels under her bed. When Sally comes back, does she expect her high heels to be under her dress?
Got it. Okay, that's helpful. Reasoning.
These reasoning skills that are, you know, important just in, you know, in everyday interaction. And the reason they're important is because we have complex social interactions, right? And the context of the world around us is nuanced in ways that have historically been far like unachievable for machine to understand in any way, shape, or form. But now, if machines can actually reason with human or potentially above human levels of reasoning, then that opens up whole new amazing and horrific doors. For example, recently, I want to say it was the last six months, Meta created a large language model that could play the game of diplomacy. Now, for those who aren't familiar with diplomacy, this is a game that has no randomness. There's no dice throws. There's nothing that a machine would game in the sense like chess, when you can calculate out positions to a certain degree of that humans are really difficult at doing. It's a game about social interaction. You use words to convince and persuade your fellow players to move in certain ways so that you can win the game. Historically, politically, it's been lauded by several politicians as a really interesting game of literally like diplomacy, right? Because you're trying to persuade. Well, Meta's large language model entered a world championship and beat some of the best players in the world at this game of persuasion. So now you have large language models that can reason in some ways using theory of mind tests better than humans. They can persuade in some ways better than humans. And it doesn't take very far a line of thought to think about how that can be misused for spam, for extortion, or a political manipulation, right? Of advertisements, all sorts of things. I mean, we're creatures of emotion. Once you start to tweak, as we've seen even with the studies on social media, when we start to tweak our emotions, you can have humans do things that are very, very scary.
Yeah, holy moly.
Another interesting thing is that OpenAI recently stated that they feel like they could create artificial general intelligence for an investment around $100 billion, which is an amazing amount of money. However, the idea of being able to create artificial general intelligence, which is the ability for AI to basically do any generalizable human cognitive ability so that when they have an unfamiliar task, they could still find a solution. Now, we think of AI today in the sense of what's narrow functions, like I'm searching for the right route to get to the convenience store, or I'm searching for the right song to listen to, or a movie in a playlist. But artificial general intelligence would enable us to have software entities that could do any human cognitive function in a manner indistinguishable from a human. And this is something that has been thought perhaps impossible even for us to accomplish. And now we're actually considering, well, if we had this amount of money, maybe we could get that.
Super interesting times.
Very interesting times.
It's hard not to see a lot of concerning outcomes from something like that.
Yes. I mean, you're right. There's great reason to be concerned. And I don't remember the stats specifically, but in a recent study, I believe it was found that 50% of AI researchers gave it a 10% or greater chance that in the next 100 years, AI could lead to human extinction.
Yeah. Yeah, the odds, that's not a fun thing to think about. But there's almost certainly a flip side to that too, right? I mean, I think that it's very easy with the unknown to think about some of the really concerning outcomes. And, there's always two sides. So that's why it requires discernment, intention, and, hopefully the good side wins.
So yeah, that's a great point. And to that point, in just the last few weeks, one of the modern pioneers of AI, a pioneer of deep learning, actually back propagation, Geoffrey Hinton, left Google, where he was a distinguished engineering fellow. And the reason he left was to go on a tour and basically talk about the dangers associated with AI and the tools that he's helped develop. And to your point about it being complex and there's pros and cons, one of his colleagues, another premier AI researcher, Yann LeCun, is saying, hey, talking about the good sides and saying we need to focus on that. So there's not agreement amongst researchers around where this is going to head, and no one can really predict it. We couldn't even predict what we recently discovered in the OpenAI GPT-4 models. So we have really no idea where this is all heading.
Okay, there's a lot to go there. And I think, let me ask you another seemingly impossible question generated by ChatGPT. How can organizations measure the impact of AI and chatbots on their social impact work? Are there specific metrics or indicators that they should be tracking to ensure that they are achieving their goals?
I do think it's important to measure where AI is used in your service delivery. It's very important to track that. And in general, there's challenges on understanding where technology sits inside organizations. Like, just think about if you know, like, how many data systems or software systems do you use at your office every day? Most people have no idea how many systems. What do they do? How do they interact? Where do they connect? Where does data move from one system to another, right? And, you know, in many ways, that creates some challenging circumstances, but nothing on the level of that once we get large language models or generative models into our workflows. So tracking where these tools sit inside a workflow is very, very important, right? And then that enables you to look at both process outputs, but also the greater outcomes, whether they're health or education, and then try to see, are these models helping or hurting? But it all starts with being able to know intentionally where they're being used. So when you're bringing in new tools into your workplace or new software, we're seeing these models put into software across the board right now. You know, Bing is using it. Salesforce just created a Slack capabilities using GPT in Slack. And we're going to see this more and more every single day. So understanding where and how they're in use is one area, way that we can track that.
For sure. And that's, you know, like I said, that is an almost impossible question because the utility is unknown, right? I mean, this is like the early days of the internet. We don't know, you know, how much of an impact this is going to have. So to be able to measure that is quite challenging. However, I think what you provided is great advice for any tool that you're implementing, you know, new to your, to the work that you're doing too, and especially so in areas like this when there's a lot of unknowns.
When we talk about tracking and measuring, one of the things that comes to mind is, okay, so I imagine one of our listeners going to ChatGPT and putting these questions in, right? And then saying, give me an answer, ChatGPT. And I wouldn't be surprised if the model could give better answers in many ways than I can myself. So I think that we need to be sure that we're also incorporating AI in the measurement of AI itself. And you're going to see this concept more and more. So in cyber warfare, we already have AI systems that are combating other AI systems. And one of the best ways to actually curb the potential misinformation of AI and or train AI to be better and more factual is using other AI systems. So we're quickly moving into a realm where humans are going to not be the best at doing something, especially when AI starts getting involved. So one of the ways we can measure the impact of AI is use AI to measure the impact of AI. Now, if you're sitting there going like, well, gosh, why don't you just say, like, keep humans in the loop? Yeah, this is going to be our new world. Like, we're going to have multi-layered of human and AI interaction, and human machine interactions, and threading those together is going to be one of the main problems that we need to solve, like how to do that in the near future.
Here's another question from ChatGPT. How do you see AI and chatbots affecting the job market, particularly in industries that rely heavily on human labor for social impact work? Are there concerns about job displacement or the devaluation of certain types of labor?
Oh, this is huge. This is absolutely huge. Already, you know, you see both anecdotally, if you go online, I saw a post the other day from someone whose job actually funny enough, was creating podcast show notes. And they've been training for years on how to do this really well. And almost overnight, they lost, you know, 75% of their clients who are just using ChatGPT for that. Okay. Now that's an anecdotal note there. IBM announced thousands of jobs that they were predicting that they're not going to need now from using AI tooling. An educational online platform I wasn't familiar with, and because I don't do learning management systems, but their name is Chegg's. And their stock price like was lowered within the last few months by something like 50 or 60%. And they're saying that that's in large part due because students who are using their online learning system are now going to ChatGPT-4. So markets are being in almost real time restructured. And it used to be, we thought that the rote, repetitive, like box movers in the warehouse were the ones, oh, we're gonna get robots in there, and then the people moving boxes around a warehouse are not gonna be, they're gonna see their you know, jobs go down over time, or the truck drivers, we got autonomous vehicles. Oh, but now it's like lawyers, doctors, knowledge workers. So AI is coming in a way that's unpredictable, and there's really kind of, there's not many people safe from it right now. So we're just at the very beginnings of that, but we're gonna continue to see economic restructuring in new and interesting ways, and probably faster than we're all prepared for.
Well, thanks y'all so much for tuning in to today's episode of Assimio Decoded. We hope you enjoyed the conversation about ChatGPT and beyond. If you haven't already, please be sure to subscribe to Assimio Decoded so that you don't miss future episodes.